I don't have the microphone, Max, so anything you say will be recorded. Oh.
I guess I can put it on.
Okay, so the title of my talk, Computing Entanglement and Simulations of Quantum Condensed Matter, really I'm going to talk about computing Renyi entanglement entropy in quantum Monte Carlo. Okay, so this is work done mostly by us, you know, across the wrong side of the tracks at University of Waterloo, in collaboration with a few people. So Anne Callan, who's sitting at the back. A large portion of this work is work that's going into her master's thesis here at University of Waterloo. Ivan Gonzalez is a DMRG expert who we work with in Spain. He's at the Supercomputing Center in Galicia. I don't know what that acronym stands for. It's in Santiago de Compostela. So they have some specialty machines in Santiago that are large memory machines. These things can have hundreds of gigs of memory per node. So they're well suited to do sort of large-scale DMRG simulations. This is our machine room at University of Waterloo. We do a lot of serial sort of farming with quantum Monte Carlo, so I'll talk about that. And then finally, Matt Hastings, who most of you probably know, who's at Station Q. Okay, so there's a couple recent papers on the stuff I'm going to talk about. So really the goal of this work is to introduce or develop a method to calculate entanglement entropy essentially in quantum Monte Carlo, or in what I'm saying, calling a scalable simulation procedure. So why use quantum Monte Carlo is one question, right? And so the idea behind this is that we can really access very large lattice sizes in quantum Monte Carlo. Okay, quantum Monte Carlo typically scales as n, or n squared, as I'll talk about. And the idea is that if we were going to calculate these things that Max talked about, subleading corrections to the area law, so imagine a region A entangled with a region B, L is your boundary there, we can really get away from the sort of lattice, the lattice size, which you want to get away from if you're going to compare any of these results to stuff that's done in the continuum. So quantum Monte Carlo or similar scaling methods, of course, DMRG is the one that we have in one dimension, right? And so the idea that we can calculate von Neumann entanglement entropy in DMRG is well known. We have direct access to the reduced density matrix there. So in quantum Monte Carlo, maybe this isn't so obvious. And so, like I say, Max did all the hard work, and the reason I'm talking about this in the context of condensed matter, I guess, is that anything we can simulate with quantum Monte Carlo, any condensed matter type system, we hope to be able to access really subleading corrections to the area law, if you will, as a resource for identifying new phases, universality at phase transitions. A lot of the motivation behind this came out of the desire to sort of quantify spin liquids with this topological entanglement entropy. I guess not all the subleading corrections. Okay, not all the scaling of the entropy is the area law, as Max mentioned. Free fermions. I think these spin Bose metals that Matthew will hopefully talk about will have a multiplicative log correction. Okay, so there you can imagine that if we could find a spin Bose metal, in a Hamiltonian that we can simulate with quantum Monte Carlo, which isn't trivial in any sense, then we can look for essentially the scaling of the entanglement entropy to identify these types of phases. So quantum Monte Carlo, so one of our tools of choice here. Really the advantage in quantum Monte Carlo is that it's scalable in system size. So modern method scale is n, the number of lattice sites. Okay, and some methods that we use also scale as n squared. Okay, we consider this poor scaling for quantum Monte Carlo. N-squared simulations can typically be improved upon with clever tricks. You might be familiar with this, that determinantal quantum Monte Carlo, if you're used to looking at fermionic Hubbard models, for example, in two dimensions. These things scale as n cubed, as far as I understand. And if you look at some of these papers that use determinantal quantum Monte Carlo, you'll see the system sizes that they can access are quite restricted by that scaling. So the ones I'm going to talk about are scaling n or n-squared. Okay, so we have different flavors of quantum Monte Carlo. Most importantly, I think, is to differentiate between quantum Monte Carlo that operate by projecting out You know, the ground state energy at zero temperature, so zero temperature projector methods, I guess you would call them, and finite temperature quantum Monte Carlo's based on the partition function. Okay, so both of these are two flavors of quantum Monte Carlo that I'll talk about. And really the punchline is that we believe we can calculate Rényi entropy in both of these flavors of quantum Monte Carlo. Okay, so what's the problem with quantum Monte Carlo? Obviously, it's got the sign problem. Okay, it inhibits the simulation of frustrated spins and fermions. So it's sort of the bane of a lot of this this work. You know, but we should all be happy for the sign problem because I think it gives most of us jobs, really, in the end, right? So I'm not going to talk about the sign problem explicitly. I'm going to assume somehow that I can simulate whatever Hamiltonian I'm interested in. What I am going to talk about is the quote-unquote problem that simulations, quantum Monte Carlo simulations really don't have access directly to the wave function or the reduced density matrix. Right? Really what you're doing is sampling, you know, the wave function projected in some basis, if you will. And so measuring a von Neumann entropy, where you have a functional dependence on the reduced density matrix, you know, it's inside this lawn. This is something that we don't know how to do directly in quantum Monte Carlo, okay, with this sampling type procedure. So the trick to get around that is something Max mentioned, and it's the idea that we can calculate these Rényi entropies. Okay, so here's this generalized Rényi entropy characterized by this replica parameter n. Again, so it's 1 over n ln trace of rho to the n. So if you take the limit, you get this von Neumann entropy, which is the one that is most interesting to us. But I hope Max also motivated the idea that the Rényi entropies are also interesting. In particular, I'm really just going to talk about S2, okay, which is taken by putting n equals 2 there. So we can calculate some quantum Monte Carlo, as I'm going to show. The idea of analytically continuing our data to S equals 1, so I'm not so clear on that, if that's going to be something that's possible or not. Okay, so the Rényi entropies, in addition to these nice features Max talked about, you know, S2 really gives a lower bound, or rigorously on S1. So, you know, they're useful to say something in that sense about what's going on with the von Neumann entropy. And as mentioned, you know, the subleading corrections at critical points are universal, or believed to be universal, and with the condition that they depend on N, right? This topological correction, I believe, is N independent. So you know, the hotshots that did this are in the audience, so they can tell me if this is true. But I believe that that's right. It's still ln, minus ln of the quantum dimension, right? So this topological entanglement entropy, you know, if we could find a topological spin liquid that we could simulate with quantum Monte Carlo, in principle, we can measure this, right? Okay, so the first flavor, I guess, of quantum Monte Carlo that I'm going to talk about is in the valence bond basis. So it's a zero temperature projector method in the valence bond basis. And this is the first one that we realized, actually quite recently, that we can calculate the Rényi entropy basically using a variation of this replica trick. Okay, so in the next few slides, I just want to give you a flavor for how this quantum Monte Carlo goes. Okay, so this is not a complete, you know, technical description of what we do in the computers by any stretch of the imagination, but I just want to give you an idea. You know, the valence bond basis quantum Monte Carlo is really one of the simplest ones to implement. Okay, anyone in this room could do it in a couple of weeks, but it's somehow not really used that widely. I think in part because it's rather recently been developed. Maybe in the last 5 years or so, we've been looking at this. So the valence bond basis is really just the idea that we take your singlet or whatever, your valence bond, and you know we look at a basis, which I'll call V of R, you know, so here's one state, where the valence bonds are stretched out between different sites on the lattice, okay? And so we can label this, you know, particular tiling, if you will, by an R, and I have I and J are all my paired lattice sites, okay? So this is, you know, IJ for one, this is IJ for two, and so on. So in general, we're looking at some, you know, in this basis, we're looking at valence bonds, which aren't just restricted to nearest neighbor, they can be as long range or as short range as needed by the problem. And this is a massively overcomplete non-orthogonal basis. So one thing we do is we restrict the valence bonds to go between A and B sublattices. Okay, so this restriction, for technical reasons, is needed. In part, it gets rid of the sign problem in certain Hamiltonians. Okay, and in part, it reduces the number of possible states in any finite size lattice to it's n over 2 factorial, factorial, not n over 2 exclamation point. So, you know, this valence bond basis has been talked about and used for a long time. And Sandvik really popularized it with the idea that we can develop a zero temperature projector method using a valence bond basis. So these projector methods are quite familiar to the community that uses them. I don't know what that statement means, but what I mean is by us, okay? So they're the basis of Lanchos, really. Like the idea that you operate on the Hamiltonian, or sorry, you operate with a large power of the Hamiltonian on a wave function, and you project out the ground state, right? So you choose a constant in some clever way that for very large m, you know, this thing's exact and the limit of n equals infinity, but practically for very large n, you know, the second and following terms of this expansion really go to zero. So you're expanding out of the ground state. So any projector method, you know, diffusion type, quantum Monte Carlo, this stuff, Lanchos, it's all based on this idea of projecting out the ground state. For concreteness, okay, I'm going to consider the Heisenberg model. It's for concreteness and also because it's the simplest one for us to implement. And then this, you know, the Heisenberg model is a Hamiltonian. And that state there is this valence bond state that I mentioned in the previous slide. So in order to implement a projector quantum Monte Carlo in a valence bond basis, really what all you have to do is know how the Hamiltonian terms, which I'm writing as bond terms, you know, you affect basis states. So here very locally is a bond term, H, A, and B, which if operating between sites that already have a valence bond, okay, here's my valence bond here. It returns the same state back to you. Okay, locally again, this is in a neighborhood of this bond. And if a Hamiltonian term operates between B and C, which aren't connected by a valence bond, it reconnects all the valence bonds with some weight factor. Okay, so you can write this out and convince yourself of these relationships. So this is very important in some sense in the development of the quantum Monte Carlo procedure, because what we're doing in quantum Monte Carlo is we're sampling, and we have to sample the basis, so we have to sample a bunch of valence bond configurations, and we also have to sample Hamiltonian terms, okay, so bond terms, Hamiltonian bond terms which are propagating these basis states. So it's really nice to have, you know, an off-diagonal operation which affects the basis by rearranging the bonds. So by essentially sampling a large string of Hamiltonian operators of order n, you know, we get for free sampling of the basis. Okay, so it's one of the nice features of doing quantum Monte Carlo on the valence bond basis. So the projector method is simply this. So we rewrite whatever the constant in the Hamiltonian, picking some large power of m, as a sum of bond terms. And the bond terms are the things that we're sampling individually. And there's always a magic equals sign in Monte Carlo where the sum starts being done through important sampling. So, you know, that you can never really connect in your mind quite clearly what's going on maybe between these two terms. But all this is a sum of a whole bunch of different, what I'm calling bond strings, or I guess projectors or something like that. So it's just a list of bond operators. Each one of these, which makes up this string P of R, you know, there's M of them here. And there's bond 1, bond 2, bond 3, and those indices can be chosen at random or something like that. So what we're doing is affecting the sum, or doing the sum through important sampling, choosing a large M, a sequence of bond operators, this P of R, propagates an initial state. And so what I've shown here is a string P of R, and there's three terms, there's three bond terms in this string. And I'm propagating an initial state, which is valence bonds in some columnar configuration. Okay, so if this bond operator operates, say, between these two sites here, it rearranges the bonds as so. Now operate on this state with a different operator, which is affecting, oh, I don't know what I did here. No, I guess these two sites here, rearranges the bonds as so. And then there's a third one, which at the time I'm sure I knew which bonds it was working on, probably, you know, these ones here or something, which gives us a final state. Oh, man. So what we've done is we've, you know, projected out from the initial state a final state with a series of weights, and these weights are just 1/2, you know, to the power of how many off-diagonal operations there are. Right, that came directly from here. So that's one sort of expansion, and then in the quantum Monte Carlo, all we do is we sample this. So we change a bond operator at random. Okay, so I've changed this last one So instead of affecting, you know, some sites here, it affects some sites somewhere else. So we get a different projection at the end. So I'm calling it V of S instead of V of R. Okay, so we start, you know, in principle from the same state, different projection, different weight. Okay. So in a nutshell, that's basically how the valence bond basis quantum Monte Carlo works. All you have to do is construct a basis and sort of do this naive sampling of bond terms in the Hamiltonian. Why do it? Okay, well, because we can measure things, okay? The Hamiltonian, you know, the expectation of the Hamiltonian operator can be measured with a single projector. You can just project one of these things out. Here's your sum over weights. This is a typical sort of quantum Monte, or any Monte Carlo estimator. And what I'm doing here is measuring the overlap or the matrix element with some reference state, which we can choose to be a columnar state or something like that. That gives us the energy. Any expectation value, you know, within reason. Okay, there's some set of expectation values we can do. Operators, two-point correlation functions. These can be done with double projectors. So you just project two valence bond states. And the expectation value looks like that. This thing has some nice features. One is you can get really nice, well-converged results, for example, for the singlet-triplet gap, by just inserting explicitly a triplet into this method. Other features, okay, the naive algorithm scales as n squared, but an improvement can be made to make this thing scale as n using some technology related to, you know, a loop algorithm type stuff that we sort of do in this field. And in doing so, I think Sandvig's now done, you know, upwards of 10 to the 7 spins using this method, Heisenberg spins. You know, another cool thing is you can continuously change n upward from 2. So you can do any SUN model with this thing. And so Kevin Beach and co-workers came out with a nice paper recently that showed, you know, which calculated explicitly the critical n for spontaneous dimerization in a SUN model, right? So by doing some scaling collapse of these types of curves, which are just the order parameter, the Neil order parameter, they somehow, to high accuracy, extracted this critical n. Okay, again, it still has a sign problem. This idea of valence bonds existing between the A and B sublattices on a bipartite lattice, it's very closely related to like a Marshall sign theorem for this thing. And the sign problem is really the same as the sign problem in any other method, like SSE, that I'll talk about. Although some improvements might be possible, and Kevin Beach is actively working on this angle. Okay, so that was sort of the valence bond basis quantum Monte Carlo in a nutshell. So what we're interested in is measuring something called a swap operator. This swap operator, I'm going to show you, gives the Rényi entanglement entropy. So I didn't know what a swap operator was until Paolo showed us yesterday that swap operators are well known in certain fields. So for me, it was a new thing. The idea about the swap operator for us, I can show you how this relates to the Rényi entanglement entropy if I look at a product basis. Okay, so let me step away from the valence bond basis for a second. Let me write a ground state wave function between a region A and B with the basis alpha and beta. So this is like an SZ basis or something like that. Okay, and the swap operator is something that's going to operate between two non-interacting copies of this. Okay, so in two non-interacting copies, okay, so it's just a tensor product wave function. I call them real and ancillary. But you can just imagine that you can directly, if you will, code two non-interacting copies in the system. And then a swap operator is defined by swapping the basis states associated with alpha 1 and 2, between the two non-interacting copies. Okay, so you can write it formally as swap operator in this region A, which is green for me. Swapping the basis states, so you have alpha 1, beta 1 here, alpha 2, beta 2. Now you have alpha 2, beta 1. Alpha 1, beta 2. Okay, so it's sort of the simplest way to define the swap operator. So once you have that definition, you can take the expectation value in this extended system, okay, this two replica system. And the expectation value, okay, you can convince yourself, it's written out in terms of these matrix elements. The sum over the beta degrees of freedom here is like doing the trace and the reduced density matrix, right? Or you're like tracing out the degrees of freedom associated with B, with the entangled region. And then it gives you back trace of rho squared. Okay, so trace of rho squared is this thing inside the Rényi entropy. So the second Rényi entropy, if you will, rho A, just minus ln trace of rho squared. So it's just minus log of the expectation value of the swap operator. Okay, so we can measure that directly. The only sort of subtlety is that we're working in a valence bond basis. And the way that the swap operator works in the valence bond basis, you just got to be a little bit careful with. But it's actually quite nice. So here I have a one-dimensional system. You know, this is my region A. Now it's white for some reason. This is my region B here. And I want to measure the Rennie entanglement entropy, or the expectation value of the swap operator, in this system where I've replicated it once, so I have two non-interacting copies. Okay, the way the swap operator affects this is by swapping the endpoints of the valence bonds in region A.
I believe that this is over complete. There are ways that you could write the thing on top that has bonds across. No? Because the base is overcomplete, maybe, you know, there that same state there can be written as a superposition of things that have bonds across.
What do you mean by bonds across?
Well, like, do a move that you take the last two,
yeah,
and you put a big bond between them, and then the closer together blues, you put another bond.
Okay, that's fine.
Oh, but then when you do the swap...
You're only swapping the endpoints inside region A. Okay? So the only important thing is that the bond starts in A and ends in B. There's no path through space that these bonds live, right? So I just drawn some sort of simple thing here. But you can, if you have a more complicated system, or if you have, yeah, like you say, your bonds connecting around the boundary or something, it's still, you know, the definition of the swap operation still holds there.
I believe so, anyway.
So there are no subtleties from the fact that the base is overcomplete?
Not that I know of. Not that I care about or something. Somebody else smarter than me would see a subtlety. But what I'll show you is I can get the Rennie entropy doing this. So as far as I understand, you know, the definition, I think here is clear.
It's not as easy to write some on the valence bond basis, but really it's just swapping the endpoints in region A, okay? So this is the swap configuration. See, I've taken this endpoint and put it down here. I've taken these two, which are both entirely contained in A, and put them up in the ancillary. What else? I've taken this one and moved it up. Okay, so now you have this previously non-interacting thing, or these two non-interacting copies get entangled, if you will, by the valence bonds. Okay. So the expectation value of the swap operator, you know, again, in this case, always is equal to the trace of the reduced density matrix squared, we believe. So I can show you results, because that's the only time I ever believe anything, is when the computer tells me. So here's some results, and all I've done is measure the expectation value of the swap operator. And the way we do this, we do like a Monte Carlo sum, which is represented by the big brackets. Okay, and then I have the swap operator, then it has to be normalized by the weights. The weight, in this case, is just the overlap between the two projectors that I've done, okay? So this is results for a 1D Heisenberg model. And the region L that I'm plotting down here, it's just the number of spins in region A. Okay, so it's like the linear region here. And I've calculated this S2. And as you can see, the data looks fairly good until I get about halfway. And then I get some shitty results out here that are, you know, essentially due in large part to the idea that I have these really big error bars. So something's really kind of going wrong in some sense here. But we can really converge, you know, in this region of the chain, the Rennie entropy to the exact result, which we can easily calculate in DMRG. Okay, so that's the black. So open boundary conditions in this case, because DMRG is like faster. You can do it either way, right? Open, periodic, we've checked all of these things. So why do I show this this bad data? Well, it's one, it's to get across the idea that there's some noise, if you will, associated with measuring these swap operators. And it has to do with sampling. You know, the naive sampling of the swap operator, as you increase the region L, if you will, so as Max told us, you know, as we know from conformal field theory, the scaling of the Rennie entropy, you know, should have some form like this, dependent on log of L, and A is related to the central charge and so on. So it really means the expectation value of the swap operator is getting poorer and poorer as we increase this region L, and we can directly see this reflected in these very large error bars with the expectation value of the swap operator. Okay, so we recognize that fact, and we can fix it. And the way we can fix it is you know, common trick in Monte Carlo. You know, really the problem boils down to the idea that the, you know, the portion of configuration space that you're sampling, you really sample it because the weights of the simulation are peaked. The distribution's peaked in that portion of this really high-dimensional configuration space that the Markov chain walks through. But, you know, it doesn't mean that the expectation value of the thing you're measuring is peaked in that space, right? So you have to do something. You have to skew the weights of your simulation in order to move it over closer to that region that you want to sample. And we can do that in a sort of naive way by running the simulation with a weight that is related to the swap operator itself. So we call this an improved estimator. It's really the ratio of two swap operators, which gives us a difference of Rényi entropies. Okay, so we can always extract a Rényi entropy for some larger region if I know the Rényi entropy for some smaller region. And this notation I means that I'm performing a simulation, for example, with L equals 4 in the weight. Okay, so I've changed the simulation weight. It occurs on the bottom here. And I'm measuring the swap operator for I plus 1, I plus 2, which is I plus J up to some J max. Okay, so I've replotted some quantum Monte Carlo data, which is blue, using J max equals 5. So that's the maximum distance I went away from the boundary. And Anne's probably cringing because we have a much better converged data in this middle part of the chain, which I was too lazy to make a new slide for. So the question?
Size here?
100.
But then isn't Rényi entropy mutual? I mean, why does it become?
It is mutual, but
you know, in
problem for L.
Because we're sampling, you know, we're sampling based on, okay, like in this plot here, right? We're sampling starting from you know, L equals 0, where we get the best sampling, and then we get very bad sampling out in this region. So I mean, we don't have to do this. You're right. We can take this and reflect it. I mean, that's the exact result, right?
But why is this sampling, say, for L equal 100 worse than for L equal 0?
It's just because we contain, in this region L, you know, 100 or 99 spins or something like that. Okay, so, I mean, this is how the Monte Carlo works, right? The expectation value, the number of times you're sampling according to that one site, if you have, you know, 99 regions, very small, right? So you get a very big noise component. I mean, you can simulate the complement region, which is the smart way to do this, right? I'm just illustrating the fact that there's some noise associated with large regions. So if you're doing a real thing, you know, you
simulate the complement regions in some smart way because, like you say,
not L2 minus A, it's basically the minimum of the two, right? Or it should be a periodic function of, or almost periodic to some extent, right?
I don't know.
It's the entropy of the two parts of the
period. Yeah. So definitely
you get over the half, and, you know.
But why is there much more noise for a large compared to a small?
But this is just the first half of the chain.
Yeah.
Minus.
I mean, I'm quite,
so you get in trouble.
I mean, this idea somehow was fixed when we improved the sampling, but I guess I never thought of it in that terms. Okay, let's come back to it, because how much time do I have?
10 plus 5.
Yeah, okay. So maybe that's a good point. But
let's just go into two dimensions, okay? I can do the same thing in two dimensions. And, you know, it's interesting now you mention this because we see the same problem with the sampling, essentially, right? So in two dimensions, I have some region here, you know, and as this region gets bigger, you know, if you believe maybe in the area law, I can say that, you know, the expectation value is going to be exponentially somehow decreasing, right? But this isn't a problem unless I get to some larger lattice sizes. So now the analogy of this J max is somehow the linear size of my region A. And I can measure the bare swap operator. So this is an 8x8 system, like this one pictured here, with periodic boundaries now. Okay, and I increase this convergence parameter, if you will, in the weights. And I can see that basically everything's the same for L equals 8. Whereas for L equals 16, okay, I have some large noise and I have some result here that converges, you know, more or less quickly. as I increase this parameter. So this is, again, affecting the weights. And by R max equals 2 or 1, my curves lie on top of each other, so I hope that the things converge. Okay, so these are results. I can take all the converged results for a bunch of different system sizes and plot them together. Okay, so now we don't have any of these sampling problems left in the system. We've gotten rid of the whole thing. And so this is between L equals 4, so 4 by 4 system with a 32 by 32. Okay, here's the area law, or what might you expect if we have the entanglement entropy S2 divided by L, where L is the linear size, again, of that region, right? And what we're seeing, you know, some, I guess I could call it a subleading correction, you know, which I guess somebody told me 45 minutes ago or so, this should be an additive or subtractive logarithmic form to the area law, so it's something interesting there. And the main point, I guess, is that, you know, this simulation still scales as L, n squared when we're doing the sampling. So 32 by 32 is what you can reasonably get in, like, I think I did, you know, roughly a month of a month of computer time on like 100 CPUs or something like that, right? So it's not a very big simulation, actually. One take-home message, if you're thinking about physics, is that there's not a multiplicative log correction in the Neel state, okay? And at risk of being accused of making a straw man to burn somehow, you know, certain people, I guess, did believe that somehow there was a multiplicative correction. Looking at other entanglement measures, namely this valence bond entanglement entropy, where you just measure the number of valence bonds crossing the boundary between A and B. This thing shows a clear multiplicative log dependence. So if you plot valence bond over L versus L, I've got some log scale in a straight line here. There's a very clear log dependence. And in contrast to any of these trivial gap phases, which showed a nice area law in this measure. Okay, so this thing, this multiplicative log correction, is really an artifact of a different definition of valence bond entanglement entropy that was used in these types of simulations in the past. Okay, I want to move on to some more recent work. Okay, so there's more work needed on proving the statistics, and this ratio trick is one way to do it, but, you know, we want to also improve the simulation scaling to n, so we can trivially go to 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 7 simulation sites. Okay, and some other more sophisticated multi-canonical histogramming is probably the way to go about this. One other note is that the more replicas you have, you know, the higher n you can calculate. So you can just keep replicating this and redefine your swap operator and calculate any of these Renyi entropies, we believe. Okay, two downsides to this method. I mean, you're really stuck with Heisenberg-type spins or SUN models. We'd like to be able to extend this to, other types of models that we do with other flavors of quantum Monte Carlo. And in particular, I guess other flavors of quantum Monte Carlo that work away from strictly zero temperature also. Okay, so I mean, this is a physics type issue. Do you want to look at other models, you know, that basically your U1 or boson models or something like that away from T equals zero? Okay, so I'm going to move on and very briefly tell you about how we believe we can do this. Okay, so this is calculating Renyi entropy in finite temperature quantum Monte Carlo. I'll show you how we can do it in the stochastic series expansion method. Okay, so this is very recent work. It's unfortunate I'm getting filmed, so I trust no one to scoop me. And this work done between, you know, Hastings, he's the brains, and I'm the looks behind this thing. Stochastic series expansion. Okay, this is really our workhorse. This is the n-scaling simulation method. We can do spin boson models, and it's really based on the partition function. Okay, you expand the partition function. You expand the exponential in the partition function. And then here's that magic step where you're sampling basis, SZ basis states. You're sampling a string of bond operators. Okay? Here's a one-dimensional representation. I have a 1D system with a bunch of spins down and one spin up. And you can think of this as like a D plus 1, like an imaginary time expansion up here. Okay, I can do diagonal or off-diagonal operators in the sampling. So the red are off-diagonal. So what they do is they flip two spins on a bond. Diagonal don't do anything. They affect the weights, of course, but they don't change the basis. And then the idea behind this finite temperature quantum Monte Carlo is really that the trace in this partition function is written as a sum over diagonal matrix elements. It's a really important point because it means this basis state down here has to be the same as when you've done the expansion. Okay, so up here, you know, if I flip the spin along the way, or if I hop the boson, I have to hop that boson back in order to get non-zero contribution to the partition function. Okay, so this looks like a world line. And it smells like a world line. It's like it is a world line, right, for this particle. So all these methods are related, like this continuous time worm algorithm, quantum Monte Carlo, and SSE, path integral methods that we do, ab initio simulations of helium, and so on. They're all somehow related to this idea, this partition function. And this boundaries are really important. Okay, so a neat thing we can do is directly implement the replica trick in the D plus one dimensional simulation cell. Okay, so Max already told you about this. The replica trick, the key thing is the trace over rho to the n is the ratio of two partition functions, a modified partition function, Z-A-N-T. Okay, that's how I'm labeling it, because it depends on region A and n and the temperature, over the regular partition function raised to that power. Okay, so this is n-sheeted Riemann surface. So this semi, you know, this replica trick, this partition function, if you will, looks like something with sort of more complicated connected boundaries into region B, right? A is entangled with B. And here we have Z A2T. Okay, so there's two sheets in region B corresponding to this parameter 2 here. And in region A, the simulation cell, if you will, in the second or in the imaginary time dimension has just been doubled. So this replica trick you can do for, you know, 3, 4, how many ever sheets you want in this region B. Okay, so all you have to do in the SSE or any of these finite temperature methods is directly implement the replica trick into your simulation cell. Right? That sounded easy when I said it there, but it takes a little bit of coding, I guess, in some sense. So really, the way that this is affected in a SSE simulation is by affecting this periodic boundary that's associated with these world lines, if you will, with these bosons hopping. So if I'm in region A here, my particle or my spin, which can be exchanged, or my boson, which can be hopped, has to hop back so that this site here, is the same as this site here for the world line. In these two regions, the two sheeted regions, the periodic boundaries are modified so that, you know, this boundary has to match this boundary, like this, and this boundary has to match this boundary, but they don't have to match each other, right? So the basis state in the red and the blue don't have to match like they do in this other region here. So think about it, just like directly implementing this replica trick in quantum Monte Carlo gives you access to this partition function. Okay, or more accurately, you're simulating according to the weights of that partition function. So there's another detail, and the detail is that we can't directly measure the partition function in quantum Monte Carlo, or classical Monte Carlo, or anything. So we're saved a little bit because we're looking at the logs. So log of the two partition functions, so we get log of top minus log of the bottom. It looks like a free energy, right? And through some procedure where we can do, for example, thermodynamic integration, we know the entropy at high temperatures for both of these cases, and we can do an integration of the entropy, of the energy or the specific heat over T or something like that, and extract in the same way people do in classical simulations, you know, essentially what looks like the free energy, right? So this is something I ran over the weekend, L equals 6 Heisenberg model. This turned out all black, but this is the regular partition function. These are 1, 2, 3, 4. These are for different regions of linear size 1 to 4 here. So we get really smooth data in a matter of, you know, over a large temperature regime in a matter of a few hours. And then this integration, you know, I just do this integration. So at high temperature, you have these high temperature entropy contributions here. Your entropy is disappearing. And this really small difference here, that small difference is the zero temperature Rényi entropy or whatever you're looking for. Okay, so there's an additional complication when you're doing this in the sense that you have to do some sort of thermodynamic integration. Okay, so again, I just ran these things over the weekend for 4x4 and 6x6. Okay, and I plotted them with the purple on top of my old zero temperature results that I showed from the Bayons-Bond basis. So 4x4 worked, and I got some, you know, work to do still on 6x6. Really, these are small-scale simulations. These took a couple hours on, you know, one CPU each or something like that. So this method, we hope, we'll be able to refine it and make it scalable in the near future. Okay, so we can improve on the thermodynamic integration, I hope. You know, in classical simulations, people use, you know, multi-canonical, if you will, or umbrella sampling methods and then reweighting techniques to look at the free energy. So all these tools that we have in terms of classical Monte Carlo, I think we can attack this problem with and really get rid of this these details of integration and so on. It's easy-ish to implement. So if you have an SSE that's working and you got some your favorite model, whatever it is, you can just put in this modified modified multi-sheeted simulation cell, with a few little details, and you can be measuring this as soon as tomorrow, right? The method always scales as N and B. You know, even with the implementation of this, it scales as N and beta, essentially the number of sheets too. Okay, so my time's up. So here's some conclusions. I think the main take-home thing is we can measure Renyi entanglement entropy in quantum Monte Carlo. Okay, we've only been doing it for half a year or less, but it essentially works and it's scalable and it's fairly easy to implement, so we can all start doing it. And once these sort of proof of principle measurements are out of the way, it's just a matter of a little bit of effort to start looking at subleading corrections to the area law, critical points, topological phases if we could find an easy to simulate spin liquid, things like that, right? So send us your Hamilton. No, don't send us your Hamiltonians. Okay, thank you.
Can we go back to the figure, the previous slide where you have the, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so the question is that, this guy is supposed to plateau right at one point, so that you can read the difference between the area law. But it still doesn't...
Well, there's an additive log correction. I hear.
No, wait, why is it, why does it shoot? Oh, additive, not it. But still, like, it's supposed to be, we want to get the gamma from there. How do we know how to get it?
Well, okay, maybe you have to use more sophisticated scaling, right? I don't have any, I didn't even try to extract any sort of subleading correction of this. So you have to play around with this a bit. You have to either scale the simulation cell with the size, or you have to start with a huge simulation and scale the size inside there. I mean, there's boundary effects, right? This is effect of a boundary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here, this is a 32 by 32 system, and my size A is 31 here, right? So it doesn't make sense. You're not going to be in that regime where you can extract any subleading corrections of scaling out here. So really, the important part is probably just this part in here, this data in here, and just bigger system sizes and more control on the geometries and stuff. It would be fairly easy, I think, to extract.
Any other question?
Yeah. Can you do time simulation at all?
You mean time evolution?
Yeah.
No, not really, not in Monte Carlo, right?
Yeah. No, but do you know if the valence bond basis can be useful for time evolution?
I don't, that's a short question. We do this in DMRG all the time and these other methods, right? But this depends on some details of, I guess, how the time evolution operators apply. And so I don't know much about it in quantum Monte Carlo, actually.
I meant with something in terms of this is two-dimensional, right?
This is 2D, yeah.
So, at finite temperature.
Well, this is supposed to be zero. This is a zero temperature projector result.
Oh,
and this is my integrated results here. So I'm at some.
I was confused by the finite T. So. Sorry.
Oh, just these few points here are from my integration. Okay, I just did them like on Victoria Day.
Yeah, I was wondering why you divide by L not L squared for finite T. For finite temperature, that's right.
Oh. I mean, it's, the hope is that it converges to the zero temperature results. I just divide by L. Is that what you're asking? I just divide by L. Just
the finite temperature, these things are extensive. So this,
Yeah, like up here, right? This is finite temperature results up here. I just want to change. Well, this is for one system size, L equals 6.
So all those other curves are at zero temperature in the other slide.
These ones are all
zero
temperature.
Or the proper ones.
Yeah.
Are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other question? Well, not, let's thank you so much again.
Thanks.